Welcome to part two of this episode of We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And our guests, Lisa Firth, Mary Jane Baker and Lisa Swift. That's all the one person. And Sue Hello. Clark. And we're talking about comedy and romantic comedy. And Lisa is going to reveal, I hope, the tricks, the comedic tricks that she uses in all her books. And she's written loads of them.
I'm not sure that tricks as such, but sort of tried and tested, you know, things are humorous. For example, as I was talking before about the sublime to the ridiculous, where you take, you know, your high-flown language of love. This is where romantic comedy works very well. The language of love, which is naturally sort of sonnet-like and beautiful, and then if you couple that with the sort of mundane everyday reality of being in a relationship or falling in love with somebody, that you can get some comedy out of that. The only one I can think of is from the sex scene in A Bicycle Made for Two. The sex scenes are quite good for this technique. And I think she says something like, she no longer cared what she looked like because she felt beautiful and in love, and she didn't even care how much they punished his headboard, which was banging the wall alarmingly. off the top of my head. Puns are brilliant. Terry Pratchett's very good at puns. They can always work well. Language jokes. Something Terry Pratchett does a lot that I really like doing is, I think in your first draft, you naturally use cliches quite a lot. And then you pick them up in the second draft. Either take them out because they don't add anything. There's nothing added from saying as cunning as a fox to just saying cunning. It's just such an overused cliche. If you were Richard Curtis and Ben Elton writing Blackadder, you could put as cunning as a fox who'd just been made professor of cunning, Oxford University, and that subverts your expectation of how that cliche is going to go. And it's funny because of it. One from Perfect Fit was he took to it like a duck to hoisin. I find myself doing that a bit as I write a second draft. So, yeah. Nice. And then there's a lot of dialogue in my books, a lot of dialogue-based comedy, sort of bantering back and forth, kind of playful behaviour, which is, I think, showing that the main couples are able to make each other laugh, and they're on the same wavelength when it comes to humour, is the main way that I show that these are compatible people. My books are romances, but they're sort of what you'd call bromances, really. I mean, they're building for friendship, first and foremost, and that then leads to the next stage of falling in love.
Do you find that you're in the middle of a conversation with someone and then suddenly you kind of drift off and they think, oh no, she's suddenly wanting to record this little exchange?
It does sometimes happen. Sometimes I'll think of a great response in my head and like, I can't say that. Okay, everyone can say that, so I'll put that later. Yeah, I think people are quite wary of what they say around me now.
That's an interesting thing in itself, in the fact that, I mean, I remember saying to you when we were setting up this interview that I thought that Lana, the main female character in A Bicycle Made for Two, was seemed to me to be quite like you, just from the interactions I've seen, because obviously we don't know each other, but we've interacted a little bit on social media, and she struck me as very much you. And what you said to me back was, she's me, but she's much braver. So do you use her as a kind of proxy?
All my heroines are brave, and I'm not brave. They say the things I only think, the things I can't get away with saying. You know, they're very rarely sort of shy and socially inept like I am. It is a bit of a wish fulfillment thing. I mean, they're not based on you as such, but they are your surrogate in the story. So, yeah, they always have my sense of humour. Actually, with Lana, I think, are people going to think she is based directly on me? Because her name sounds quite similar to my name. I'm actually named her after the daughter of a woman I know, but I do think about that. Are people going to read this? And it does sometimes happen. Like, my other half's mum reads all my books and goes, she said to him, I'll never look at you the same way again, because I always often include open door sex scenes in my books. I was like, don't do that. It's fiction. It's just, you can't write if you're thinking about them looking over your shoulder, but then there is a point where they will read the book and you have to deal with the fact that they've read those words that you wrote.
And not just because you said outdoor sex scene. Do you want to read a bit from your new one, your latest one, one of them?
Mid-June this one's coming out, and this is called The Never Have I Ever Club. So it's actually coincidentally become quite topical, I think, because it actually opens with heroin having a cervical exam. She's having a health scare and she's very frightened that this is going to turn out to be something serious. She discovers a little while later that in fact she's fine, but it sort of gets her to question what she's doing with her life. So she's 35, her boyfriend has left her 6 months ago, having a sort of early midlife crisis to fly to Australia and just dumped her. And she realises she's in a job that's low pay that she enjoys, but it's sort of not particularly taxing, and she wants to know, what's the next thing? What can I do? So she starts this club in her village, the Never Have I Ever Club. It's aimed at older people particularly, but anybody can join. And that they start ticking off their bucket lists and do various things, such as life drawing and things of that nature. They do Swedish massage quite early on. And this is the boyfriend who left her earlier sort of turns up at some point trying to win her back. The awkward thing is that she's now started to fall for his twin brother who lives next door. They're identical twins. So there's no open door sex scene in this one because it might be a bit awkward. This is a scene where they are having Swedish massages. I've never had a massage before, Ash told the masseuse, Soraya. Well, there's no need to be nervous, she said in a reassuring tone. We're just offering a taster massage today, a 10-minute upper body treatment, then 5 minutes of relaxation to finish. Just chill and enjoy it. Okay, thanks. Right, I'm going to start on your back. She doused her hands in sweet-smelling oil and got to work. Nice tattoo, she said, as she rubbed soft, supple hands over his body. It looks new, is it? Quite new, he murmured. I got it while I was travelling in Australia. It's an Aboriginal spirit totem. I should have guessed your lovely tan didn't come from this miserable little country, she said with a laugh, rubbing her fingers into his spine. Okay, another 2 minutes and I'll move on to your shoulders. He spent some time easing the knots from his shoulders with firm fingertips. Ash let his eyes fall closed. He'd been a bit anxious about the idea of having a stranger having such intimate access to his body. In fact, if he hadn't been so desperate to see Robin, he'd probably have given this session a miss. But Soraya was very professional, no different than a barber or a dentist, really. You have to admit, the massage felt amazing. How's that? Feel good? Soraya asked, as if reading his thoughts. Yeah, Ash let out a deep sigh, feeling the tension disappear from his muscles. Can't believe I never tried this before. That's what this group's all about, isn't it? Trying new things. I'll give you my card, and if you want to, you can book a regular session at the spa. That sounds good. She stopped to rub more oil on her hands and went to work on his lower back. Ash moaned softly. Right, all done, she said after a bit. Now, don't move for the next 5 minutes. You need to let your body relax for a while to get the full benefit. Okay, thanks, Soraya. Ash couldn't remember when he'd been so relaxed. His body felt weightless, a numb euphoria permeating his muscles. He stretched out on the mattress and let the sensation envelop him. All right, that's it for this group, he heard Robin announce after a little time had passed. Up you get, boys. Let the next lot have their turn. Ash started to push himself up, then his eyes widened and he sank back against the mattress. Will, he hissed to his brother on the bed next to his. Will had sat up and was toweling off his oil-covered body. What? Lend us your jumper, can you? Why, are you cold? Come on, I'll give it you back in a bit. You've got a t-shirt, you don't need it. Why do you need my jumper? To tie around my waist? Will stared at him, then he burst out laughing. You've got to be kidding me. What, you haven't got one? No, I haven't, which I think is pretty impressive given I've been significantly more sex-deprived than you recently. Look, it's a natural response, okay. Just give us a jumper. Everyone else seems to be fine, Will said, glancing at the old men getting to their feet around them. Oh yeah, the little blue pill brigade. I can't help being virile, can I? Full or a semi? Full. He shrugged and Will shook his head. What, it was a good massage.
That is classic funny situation.
Yeah, that's actually situation comedy. More on the situation than the language.
Something that struck me about it, though, again, reading a book, and indeed reading a lot of comedy of this kind, is it's quite often, there's a lot of dialogue, and trying to keep the dialogue sounding natural and funny at the same time is quite difficult. I mean, do you find that a difficulty, or do you find that the dialogue comes quite naturally?
I find dialogue the easiest thing to write. This is why I ended up, I think, writing the genre that I do. So when I wrote my first book, The Honey Trap, that was much more contemporary romance, and it was kind of, as I got to about the halfway point, I realised that my favourite thing to write was dialogue and funny comic conversations and situations, and I naturally gravitated towards it, so I moved towards romantic comedy from that. I naturally write so much dialogue that my books end up a bit like sitcoms. When I get to my second draft, I have to remember to go through and, you know, add some interior monologue and place setting and things, otherwise you just end up with a talking head.
Because that is the thing about a lot of comedy, and unless you're going for the slapstick, nearly all comedy is built around the words. It's built around the dialogue and the interactions of individuals. Mm-hmm. And trying to create naturalistic speech patterns that at the same time can throw a joke in there. Because if you've got someone who's popping a gag in every sentence, I mean, if that was in real life, you'd want to punch him after about 5 minutes. So there's a kind of balance between sort of staying natural but getting the funnies in at the same time.
It's much easier to do a quick fire joke with a punchline in dialogue, isn't it, than to go in for a description. You can kill the joke stone dead by having too much background and so on. You just want to hear the two lines, don't you, or the three lines.
And then you have to remember that you do also have a story to tell, so you can't let it bog you down to the extent you've got, you know, a series of brilliant one-liners that are absolutely hilarious, but you've not actually moved your pot on for the last three or four pages.
That was one of the most difficult things I found in that, you know, I've been used to writing really short things, you know, 3 minutes and stuff like that. You can't do that with a novel. And also often going for like the cheap laugh and then losing the thread or losing the emotion of the moment. That's one of the things that someone said to me early on and which I really took on board was don't be afraid of the emotion, because it's a funny book, because it's a light-hearted book, hopefully. It doesn't mean to say there doesn't have any sad moments or poignant moments or, you know, moments that make you think. You need all these, as in any book, you need all these in a different mixes, don't you? Different mixes for different books. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure the last Hilary Mantel's got some funny bits in it. It must have. It's that thick. Every book has a mixture of these things. It's how you put the ingredients together, I think.
Sue, do you remember the funniest lines you've ever written for any of your broadcasting work?
I remember one, only because Kenny Everett stole it from me. about 6 months after I wrote it, I heard him say, and I thought, well, I should have been angry, but I was terrifically flattered. There was a thing at the time, that a medical program, which was called Your Life in My Hands, very serious operations thing. And Kenny Everett did this sketch idea he pitched for me, and it was called Your Knife in My Glands. I've always wanted to use it again, but
it seems to me that at the moment the sort of current trend, I don't see a lot of new sitcoms in this country at the moment. There are some, and there are some very good ones, but a lot of what we're seeing is really what the awful portmanteau name of dramedy, where you've got a drama that's got comedy built into it. And I think a lot of that's been driven by America, because it used to be in this country that, I think it might have been Graham Linehan, was saying that there's the difficulty of writing sitcoms in this country is by the time you get to series three, you care about the characters so much, you want to start marrying them off and giving them relationships, and the whole series takes a slightly more serious turn. And it's very interesting, if you look at the early Only Fools and Horses, they're very different from the later ones when they got partners and kids and things. And it seems to me that if you look at the American way of doing things at the moment, some of them follow that route. It's like if you look at Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is consistently funny, they're only just now getting to the stage, sort of, what are we, seven series in, where people are starting to marry off and kids are turning up and things. And there's little serious elements creeping in now and some quite strong social messaging. But there's a lot of other things, you know, Community and Parks and Recreation. I mean, the Americans have been doing great stuff for the last few years, but I'm not seeing so much from this country, and I'm not sure why.
I mean, I quite like the retro look of something like Friday Night Dinner, where...
Oh, I love it.
The same thing happens every week, with variations, same characters, you always know who's going to knock on the door. The boys who are, I don't know how old the actors are, but they're starting to look a bit... grizzled to be teenage sons of Tamsin Gray. But it makes me laugh every time, and I wish that they wouldn't get too fancy with their sitcoms and their dramedies. And I really think there's a market for a half-hour familiar in some ways. I mean, the setting is always familiar, but the inventiveness of some of these things is just amazing. Bottom, I mean, that's the same thing. That's two people in a flat. That goes back to Hancock, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I like. I mean, my kids love Count Arthur Strong, and I was quite surprised. I thought they'd be rolling their eyes, but no, they like it.
Ah, radio or TV, though, because there was a bit of a schism there, isn't there, with Count Arthur?
Yeah, I don't mind the TV. I know a lot of people prefer the radio. I quite like that. But that got a bit sweet, didn't it?
If you ever do a poll of the best sitcoms of all time, the same four or five always turn up, and it's always ones where there's only been about three or four series, because it's not that they've run out of ideas, it's just that it doesn't count. I mean, I don't know whether Fawlty Towers would have been as good in a series three. There's only so many times you can smack Manuel around the head, isn't there, you know?
Comedy is very greedy, though, isn't it? You can only do that joke once, whereas you can do that romance, that scene, that fight, you know, all the other things, argument, you can do those over and over, but you can only do a joke once, really.
Which is an interesting thing again, because in America they will have big writers' rooms, so they'll all be able to bring hundreds of jokes to it. Because again, you watch an episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, just to give an example of a sitcom that's still riding high at the moment, there is a gag every 10, 15 seconds, there is a gag, and it's a good gag. Whereas we have more of a tradition in this country of sort of either a writing partnership or a single individual writing shorter runs, and maybe 6 episodes instead of 24, but of just writing this thing either alone or with a writing partner, which is a very, very different thing, because again, it's a lot harder to keep coming up with the stuff when there's just the two of you or just the one of you. But of course, that's what we all face as comedy writers with novels. You know, you don't have a writer's room sitting down writing a novel, do you?
Question for Lisa. Talking about writing teams and writing rooms, you've written a lot of books, but I was also reading that you write a huge amount, maybe twice as much as you're going to use.
I always write a very long first draft. Usually it takes me, of a romantic comedy, it takes me about probably 4 to 6 weeks. I have written a first draft in 4 weeks. I don't recommend it. It's usually about 6 weeks or slightly more. And it's usually maybe 110,000, 115,000 words. The standard for my genre is 80 to 100,000 words. I usually manage to get it down under 100 with cuts, but yeah, I usually lose at least 25,000 words from a first draft, and then that will go through various stages. So often my publisher will ask me to add various scenes, and I'll find I've gone over the recommended limit again, and I've got to cut it back down. So depressing to think of all the words you throw away. Sometimes I get reused in later books and think, oh, that was quite a good joke. There's a joke in the school of starting over that got cut from an earlier draft of Runaway Bride. I thought was quite funny, so I've put that back in. Joke. It made me laugh. So they've got they're setting up a new dog grooming business, and the hero's mum is quite naive, and so when her business partner suggests that they call it doggy style, she doesn't realise it's a joke and starts putting that on all the merchandise and explain what it really means.
That must be a wonderful feeling that you think, this is great, I can use that bit I've already written. Hooray!
You have to recycle. I've ended up removing so much stuff over the... I mean, I know when I wrote A Murder to Die For, there was a whole extra police officer character in there. And it was only after it had been to the editor and it came back and said, there's too many cops, they get confused. I had to remove that character and sort of take some of their lines and give it to other people. But there was a whole character left over at the end with their own little idiosyncrasies that got completely excised from the novel. But he became the sort of the cop in the third book, as it happens, because, you know, you could reuse all those things. A good idea is a good idea. So I don't think anything's ever really lost. If we're lucky, nothing's ever lost.
I wrote a cosy crime. It was a humorous cosy crime. I thought it was, you know, going to be in the Midsummer Murders kind of tradition. It was about a women's institute, and some little old ladies at the women's institute start getting bumped off one by one, and they're trying to work out who might be doing it. And I really liked it, but my agent wasn't a fan of this. But there was loads of great characters, and there was a great setup for it, and there was a subplot involving a romance as well. There was two subplots involving romances. So I pitched that to my publisher as a rom-com, a similar premise involving a WI but without the murders. So at some point I have to dig that out and try and work out what I can reuse from it.
Okay, that's the end of part 2. In part 3, more of the same.